responsively. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Jo sau labdha baro matto navadhya mana srishti navadhyo mama srishti bi. Tapo yoga balonadha samasta nigamanahan. This demon, Hiranyakashipu, gold cushion. That's what it means. This demon, Hiranyakashipu, received from me the benediction that he would not be killed by any living being within my creation. With this assurance and with strength derived from austerities and mystic power, he became excessively proud and transgressed all the Vedic injunctions. Distya tattanayak sadhur Mahabhagavatorbaka Tvaya vimochito mrityor Distya tvang samito dhuna. By great fortune, Hiranyakashipu's son, Prahlad Maharaj, has now been released from death. For though a child, he is an exalted devotee. Now he is fully under the protection of your lotus feet. So now this verse. Etad vapus te bhagavan dhyayataha paramatmana sarvato goptar santrasan mrityor api jigangsataha. Etad vapuste bhagavan. Etad vapuste bhagavan. Jayatak paramatmanah. Jayatak paramatmanah. Sarvato goptir santrasan. Sarvato goptir santrasan. Mrityor api jighangsataha. Mrityor api jighangsataha. Etad vapuste bhagavan. Jayatak paramatmanah. Sarvato goptir santrasan. Mrityorapi jigangsataha. Etad vapuste bhagavan. Jayatak paramatmana. Sarvato goptir santrasan. Mrityorapi jigangsataha. Etad vapuste bhagavan. Ayata. Sarvato goptir santrasan. Etad vapuste bhagavan. Jayato paramatmana. Goptar. Yeah. Sarvato goptar santrasan. Jorapij. So any ladies? Etadvapuse Bhagavan Vyayatat Paramatmana Sarvato Gopta Santrasan Mityodapi Jigangsata Etadvapuste Bhagavan Jayatak Paramatmanahan Sarvato Gopta Santrasan Mityodapi Jigangsata Etadvapuste Bhagavan Jayatak Paramatmanah Sarvato Gopta Santrasan Mityodapi Jigangsata Going, going, gone. So, Prabhupada's translation for this verse. My dear Lord, O Supreme Personality of Godhead, you are the Supreme Soul. If one meditates upon your transcendental body, you naturally protect him from all sources of fear, even the imminent danger of death. Prabhupada's purport, everyone is sure to die, for no one is excused from the hands of death, which is but a feature of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, Mrityuk Sarva Haras Chaham, from the Gita. When one becomes a devotee, however, he is not destined to die according to a limited duration of life. Everyone has a limited duration of life, but a devotee's lifetime can be extended by the Supreme Lord's mercy, for he is able to nullify the results of one's karma. Karmani nirdahati kintu cha bhakti bhajam, which that's from Brahma Sangita, which means the Lord nirdahati burns up, literally burns up karmani, all the karma, however, kintu bhakti bhajam, for those who take to devotional service. This is the statement of Brahma Sangita. A devotee is not under the laws of karma, therefore even a devotee's scheduled death can be avoided by the causeless mercy of the Supreme Lord. God protects the devotee even from the extreme danger of death. So, Prabhupada ki jai. Namo Vishnu Padaya Krishna Pristaya Bhutale Srimate Bhakti Vedanta Swaminiti Namine Namaste Saraswate Devi Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Desha Tarine Etadvapuste Bhagavan. This is Bhagavan, which is the vocative. Bhagavan is nominative. This is Bhagavan, which means, O Lord, addressing Krishna. This body of yours, Etadvapuste, this body of yours. And Vapu actually in Sanskrit means not only a body, but an attractive body. It means an attractive form. So Etadvapuste Bhagavan Dhyayatak, for one who is meditating. Dhyayataha means for one who is meditating upon that form, actually. Paramatmanaha, that form of the Supreme Soul. Sarvato, completely, fully. Gopta, actually, technically, I mean, grammatically, Gopta, which is means protector. It means protector. And it is in the neuter form in Sanskrit, which means it's actually referring to the body. The body itself is the protector. Because, of course, Krishna is his body. So, Gopta Santrasan, from calamity, from all kinds of fear, that for those who meditate upon Krishna's body, that form of Krishna, which is Krishna, of course, becomes their protector from all kinds of danger. Mrityorapi, even from death. Mrityorapi jigangsataha. And jigangsata literally means one who's trying to kill you. Anyway, this is the... we'll go into all the grammatical details. So, jigangsataha, one who's trying to... someone's trying to kill you, even death. Of course, death is trying to kill us. I mean, that's... death is, of course, also a servant of Krishna. So Prabhupada stresses in his purport here that a devotee, as the way Prabhupada used to put it, a devotee is transferred to a different jurisdiction. We are under the, an ordinary person in this world is, of course, under the laws of nature. This material world is a brilliant system created by God, created by Krishna. As Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita, maya adhyakshena, literally by my oversight, adhyaksha, or supervision. By my oversight, by my supervision, maya adhyakshena prakriti, nature, suyate, nature is producing, is giving birth to so many creatures. Maya adhyakshena prakriti suyate sacharacharam hetunaneda. Hetunaneda, because of this reason, it's by this cause. Hetunanena konte jagat parivartate. Parivartate, literally, that's what makes the world go round. Because pari means around, like Greek peri, perimeter, periscope. And vartate means to turn, to function. So literally, Krishna makes the world go round. That's what the Bhagavad Gita says. And an interesting point about the system Krishna set up in this world is that, fortunately, Krishna is not a jealous God. Sometimes in a biblical context, God is described as a jealous God. Like, you worship someone else, you are toast. So, actually, sometimes we find these descriptions of God where he needs a whole variety of 12-step programs. For anger, for jealousy, for this, for that. Fortunately, we have an emotionally healthy deity. So, Krishna is not jealous. And what's amazing in the Bhagavad Gita is that if you read it, the Gita, carefully, you can, according to Krishna, within this world, you can be happy, relatively happy. You can be wise. And you can be upwardly mobile, in the sense you could be on your way to a better next life without Krishna. This is very interesting. Because all these qualities are characteristics in the Bhagavad Gita of the mode of goodness. If you study everything Krishna says about the mode of goodness, he says it produces happiness. Of course, then he also says that you become bound by that happiness. Sukha sangena badnati. The mode of goodness does produce a kind of happiness. Krishna, of course, also says that he calls this world dukhalayam, a place of suffering. But let's say in a relative sense, Krishna says there is a kind of material happiness that comes from goodness and a kind of wisdom. Krishna says tasmat satun nirmalatvat, that the mode of goodness is nirmala. That's the same as like amala, amala harinam. Relative, free of gross impurity. Krishna says, tasmat sattvam, therefore, because sattva-gun, mode of goodness, is nirmalat, free of gross contamination, and prakashakam. Prakashakam means literally enlightening. Prakashakam, enlightening. And anamayam, again, free of amaya. Amaya in Sanskrit means like, it can mean disease, malady. So a typical greeting, if you read the Bhagavatam, when people meet each other and like, how's it going, you know, what's new? They'll say, kimanamayam often, which means no problems, everything's okay. So that's anamayam means no, someone in the mode of goodness avoids, for example, if you eat in the mode of goodness, if you look at the foods that Krishna describes in the mode of goodness, he says they promote happiness, health, and longevity. This is what Krishna says. So someone is not making himself miserable by their diet, by their eating. And also someone in the mode of goodness avoids the, let's say, the intense suffering of passion. Krishna says, rajaso dukam, from passion, as we all know, what goes up must come down. And so because passion is a type of excitability, it's becoming selfishly excited about some type of enjoyment. And then, of course, nature balances itself. I saw a bumper sticker that said, nature bats last. So because nature balances itself, if you get too excited and too greedy or lusty or just too, you know, like an excited electron just trying to enjoy, then you have to pay for it because you have to go below, let's say, normal, and it balances. So then you suffer, and your suffering kind of counteracts. So just like if you have an unhealthy lifestyle, you try to enjoy too much, and then you have diseases, injuries, whatever.
So goodness is free of that. Goodness is kind of, Krishna describes it as peaceful and all that. But sukha sangena badnati, precisely because the mode of goodness produces a kind of happiness, it binds us, Krishna says. We become attached to that happiness. And of course, the attachment to happiness is not good. It's passionate. So you can see, technically, as Krishna says, how the modes of nature turn around. Sometimes Krishna says goodness overcomes passion and ignorance, then passion overcomes goodness and ignorance, and then ignorance overcomes goodness and passion. So the seed of that fall down is already there in the experience of virtue, because one becomes attached to that goodness, or jnana sangena, because of the mode of goodness. For example, you can see it very commonly, people who are, let's say, have a little more wisdom because they are, let's say even politically, they're sympathetic or compassionate toward all people. They don't just care about the rich. They care about all people. Krishna talks about this also in the Gita in 18:20. Not, I don't mean in that year, but in verse 18:20, where Krishna is describing jnana, knowledge, in three modes of nature. And he says that knowledge and goodness, in knowledge and goodness, you see the differences of the world, gender, race, age, ability, species. You see all the differences of the world, but underlying all those differences, you see there's one state, eternal state of being. There's one spiritual reality that underlies all these differences. Whereas in the mode of passion, a person only sees the differences, cannot see the universal background behind all these differences. And therefore, let's say someone in the mode of passion is for, let's say, I'm for Democrats, but I hate Republicans, or I'm for Republicans and I hate Democrats, or I'm a nationalist, I'm for my country and I hate other countries. Or so you see, they take these dualities, these differences of gender, of race, of species, of nationality. They take these things to be fundamental. People are just different. And that's the end of it. People are just different. Whereas in goodness, you see behind the differences, there's a oneness. And that's Krishna's, basically, a summary of the difference between jnana, which in this case means like worldview. Because if you look at how Krishna analyzes in chapter 18, jnana and buddhi, buddhi is like analytic intelligence, breaking things up into their components. What is to be done? What is not to be done? What is dangerous? What is not dangerous? So buddhi, these are the two methods of reasoning. You break things down into their different parts and compare them. That's analytic. That's called buddhi. Or jnana, you put it all together and see the big picture. And so Krishna describes the big picture in different modes of nature. So there's a type of wisdom. People who are humanitarians or who are environmentalists or animal rights, this, that. But there's a kind of pride because they know, I know more than these other people. These other dummies don't get it. And so one becomes attached to having superior knowledge. So the mode of goodness produces happiness and knowledge. But if we don't have the higher taste, if we're not Krishna conscious, and we don't see ourselves as eternal servants of Krishna, then inevitably the payoff of virtue, which is wisdom and happiness, seduces us. We become attached to it. We become proud. That pride and attachment are passion, not goodness. And so passion makes a comeback. It's like all these diseases they thought they'd licked. You know, like vaccines and then the disease. It looks like the disease was out, was down but not out. And so, you know, all kinds of diseases are coming back now. So the same way, someone in the mode of goodness may temporarily have surpassed passion, but passion is not out of the game. And there will be a comeback of the mode of passion. Still, Krishna, if, for example, there was a time in India before Buddhism, before the Muslims came and killed all the Buddhist priests, which was, you know, I guess their concept of ecumenical dialogue. But at a time when there was still Buddhism in India, there were these fierce debates going on thousands of years ago for the hearts and minds of people, the people of Bharata. And so one of the Buddhist arguments against Buddhism, so-called Hinduism or the Vedic culture, was that you have these whimsical gods. So karma It's like this question raised by Socrates in a dialogue called the Euthyphro. It's a very interesting question. He said, are certain activities good, morally good? Are certain activities morally good because the gods love them? Or do the gods love these activities because they are good? In other words, are punishment and reward at the mercy, or do they simply depend on the whims, the caprice of powerful beings? Or do these powerful beings themselves obey an objective, reasonable moral code? And so the Buddhist argument against the Vedic sense of karma was, because you have these deities, and even in our Bhagavatam, sometimes Indra is, you know, kind of acting out. Indra or other gods, or sometimes Brahma becomes bewildered. So therefore they said these are imperfect gods who are imposing punishment and reward, whereas in Buddhism, because we don't have these deities, which actually was not true, because Buddhism only became a world religion when it imitated Hinduism. That's another story. The history. But it's just an objective law. How there's an objective law in the universe that responds at a very subtle level to the inner intentions of human beings, and yet the universe is impersonal, is something they could never figure out, and finally gave up and just embraced all kinds of personalism, which in Mahayana Buddhism. But anyway, that's the history of Buddhism. But actually, if my point here is, if you look at the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is saying very clearly that punishment and reward do not come from a jealous God, like, what? You didn't please me? You didn't worship me? I'm just gonna mess you up so bad. Or like, for example, if you look at the Iliad and the Odyssey by Homer, where Zeus, for example, will simply say, I don't like that dude down there. I'm gonna get him. And then Hera's wife will say, but why, Zeus? He's a nice guy. I know, I just don't like him. So this type of favoritism, in fact, the Bhagavatam really emphasizes, if you read it, there are many, many verses, and even Krishna himself describes in the Gita, that he's not playing favorites. Because if you look at ancient civilization, this is so common. I mean, even, for example, with all due respect, in some forms of Christianity, where if you just make certain subtle theological mistakes, God will torture you forever. I mean, it's obviously irrational. The punishment monstrously does not fit the crime. And so the notion of irrational deities, just who are almost like drunk with power, people that, because I have the power to torture you, I will torture you if you don't please me in every way. So there's so much of this in the history of the world, where you have these so-called deities, and then religions become corrupted. Priests are trying to coerce people into following and them as representatives of these deities, and therefore all kinds of crazy stories come out about these gods doing crazy things to people. And of course, as we know from the Bhagavatam, these are not made up stories, but the gods themselves are in some ways conditioned souls. Therefore, in order to make clear that this is not what we're not talking about this. Krishna, for example, says in the Gita, Nadate kasyachit papam, that I don't accept responsibility for anyone's sinful activity, naiva sukrit, nor their good activities. Krishna says, I don't cause, the Lord does not cause you to do good or bad. Your own nature is acting. And Krishna says, sumoham sarvabhutesha, I'm equal to everyone. Sumoham sarvabhutesha, name dveshosti, I don't hate anyone. Name priya, I don't favor anyone. Krishna says, Jijata mam prapadyante, as you approach me. Tam sataiva, exactly in that way, tataiva. Exactly in that way, I respond to you. And the Bhagavatam, after you get these, whenever you have these battle scenes of the demons and the devotees, and then Vishnu comes and defends the gods, you always find these statements afterwards that, but Krishna is not really playing favorites. Krishna is not partisan. He's not just taking sides. He's simply acting appropriately based on reasonable standards. So similarly with Krishna's standard of karma, you get what you deserve. If you act piously in this world, but you're not Krishna conscious, then you'll get the result. And if you act impiously, you get the result. So then here we have, so when Krishna says here, or the verse says here, that Krishna's body, actually the body, protects those who are meditating upon it because they've come to Krishna. It's like if I'm giving out, let's say, well, after the class, I always give out free prasadam here, which is actually why I come. And so if you don't go and put your hand out and don't get prasadam and then complain about it, you didn't go. You didn't. The prasadam was there for everyone, but you didn't take it. So Krishna is offering his protection to everyone. We simply have to take it. Then maybe one last point I'll make here is that you, even linguistically, you can see how we are one with Krishna and yet different, because there's all these words you'll find in the Gita and the Bhagavatam which are used both for Krishna and the living entity, like Atma. We are described as Atma, soul, but then Krishna is Paramatma, the Supreme Soul. Similarly, we are Purusha. In the Gita, Krishna often describes us in the Bhagavatam as Purusha. We are persons. We are eternal persons. But Krishna is the Uttama Purusha, or if you put it the other way, the Purushottama, the ultimate person, the supreme person. Similarly, we are Brahman, but Krishna is Parang Brahman. He's the supreme Brahman. So even linguistically, you can see that there are so many words that refer both to us and God, but Krishna is the supreme in each category. So, one point here, Krishna, of course, does protect us. I mean, God. There's no other explanation but God to explain why I'm still alive, considering the way I drove when I first got my driver's license. I mean, when I was 16, 17 years old, it's actually a miracle. I mean, if I was a Catholic, I would probably be beatified and become a saint because I performed the miracle of surviving despite the way I drove when I was a teenager. But Krishna actually is protecting us at every moment. All of us, if we think about every time you drive your car, when you're driving your car and we're going these high speeds, just one tiny mistake on your part or someone else's part, just a slight mental lapse, and horrible things can happen. So actually, at every moment, Krishna's protecting us. There's so much danger in this world, and at every moment, Krishna's protecting us. Also, a devotee does not die in another sense, because as we know, devotees ultimately leave their bodies. But the life that we have chosen, this life of serving Krishna through his pure representative Prabhupada, will go on. This life will not be interrupted. Even though we may change our body, we will continue with the same life. There's this beautiful story in the sixth canto of Dadichi Muni, where it's kind of like the ultimate Sankirtan line. The demigods ask him to give his body. Hey, could you throw in your body? You know, the last sage gave it. So, because they needed his bones. They needed Dadichi's bones to make a thunderbolt for Indra. That's how Indra got his thunderbolt. And so they asked him, you know, would you like to throw in your body? So, of course, Adichie, who's a liberal, says, yeah, sure, I can donate that. So, but he was so ecstatic, he was so Krishna conscious, that when he left his body, he didn't even notice it. It's like, let's say you're ecstatically dancing in a kirtan, and then when the kirtan's over, you realize, like, I don't know, your chadar fell off, or something, you dropped something you didn't notice. And so he... like, where'd I put that body? And he didn't even notice. And Prabhupada says in his purport that if we are really Krishna conscious, we do not lose consciousness even at the moment of death. I mean, that's a good thing. You know, who wants to go through like this, you know, blackout and then you wake up somewhere? It's so a Krishna conscious person remains conscious. There's actually no interruption of consciousness even by death. There's a great story in the fourth canto when Dhruva Maharaj is preparing to leave this world. And then there's this typical scene that you'll find so often, like in movies and classical stories, where death himself approaches Dhruva. It's like one of those Twilight Zone episodes where death himself is coming. And so there is Dhruva about to get on the Vaikuntha airplane, Air Vaikuntha, and death comes. But instead of like being some kind of ooh, eerie Twilight Zone scene, actually death came to offer obeisances to Dhruva, and then Dhruva stepped on the head of death, used death as a boarding ladder, and just got on this flight of Air Vaikuntha and took off. So death actually bowed to Dhruva. Death became his servant. Death became his admirer. And Dhruva also did not lose consciousness. In fact, the Bhagavatam doesn't even say he died. It just says he stepped on the head of death and got on the Vaikuntha airplane. So Dhruva and Adichie are both examples of great devotees who did not lose consciousness at the time of death. With their eyes open, they just went on to bigger and better things. So all these glorious results are possible by Prabhupada's mercy if we seriously practice Krishna consciousness. So, thank you very much. Any questions? Yes. Naikama? Oh. Over here? Oh, the microphone, right. That's right, this is a talk show format.
Thank you, Maharaj. Your last comment about how the devotee doesn't experience a change of consciousness. So is it fair to say then when great exalted devotees like we have in our disciplic line, Mahabhagwats, and great souls like Bhishma Dev, they're also experiencing that same uninterrupted consciousness?
Oh yeah, Bhishma, Prabhupada. In fact, the Bhagavatam, the sages, for example, in the case of Parikshit, they ask, they want to hear about Janma and Vilapa. They want to hear about his birth and death because the so-called passing, or not so-called, it is a passing, the so-called death of a great devotee is also glorious. It's just another glorious spiritual event. Next.
Thanks for the class.
Thanks for coming.
I was just wondering when you talk about like everyone has like a limited duration of life, like what if someone, you know, is like performing pious activities, like do they still have a set duration of life and in their next life they're just going to enjoy for those pious activities, or can like pious activities extend one's life this current lifetime?
That's an interesting question. You know, do you get your karma in this life or the next life? I would say it varies. But in general, Prabhupada is emphasizing here, everyone has limited duration life, but a devotee's lifetime can be extended. So certainly the spirit of Prabhupada's comment is that for a non-devotee, you do take the karma that you built up previously, and if you do good things, then they'll come in the future. Yes, Sachitanoya Mahaprabhu.
Thank you, Maharaj. In the verse that you quote about Brahma Sanghita, Karmani
Dahati Kintu,
it says that the Lord rewards them. When we hear the statement in the Bhagavad Gita where it says, Konteya Pratyanihina me bhakta pranashati, declare boldly that my devotees will never perish. At that point, it appears to be like if he will be a little bit more like partial, because he's happily actually doing that. He wants to reward his devotee happily more than...
Yes, but in the Bhagavad Gita, Krishna is asking everyone to become his devotee. He says, man mana bhava mad bhakto. Right. So it's like saying that we're going to have prasadam distribution at this place. Please come. So if you don't go, that was your decision. But Krishna says, bhava mad bhakto, become my devotee. And how can someone not perish, or how can their persona, their false ego, their identity not perish if they choose something material? I mean, any fool can see that material things are temporary. Any fool can see that the body's going to die, although as Yudhishthira said in the Mahabharata, the most amazing thing is people hope they won't die. But anyone can see. So if I choose to pursue happiness in something which is obviously temporary, if I accept as my identity something obviously temporary, like, in other words, if I identify with the body, I'm an American, or I'm this, or I'm that, then how can I expect it to last? We already know it's going to perish. So if a person chooses the temporary, how can they expect the eternal? If you choose the eternal, then you'll get the eternal. Yes. Microphone for Archita Prabhu.
Hi, Bob Mars. Thank you for enlivening and enlightening class. We accept, obviously, that Krishna is not partial. He's not a jealous God. But, you know, somebody reading who's not a devotee reading the Gita, reading like 16th chapter, Tanahan, Drishata, Kruran, Sangsarishu. You know, it seems like Krishna's saying, I'm going to cast you forever into the demonic species of life. And, you know, you're not going to get out.
That's a misreading of the Sanskrit. First of all, Krishna says, Dvishata, those who are hateful, and Kruran, cruel. And what he says is that ajastram, perpetually. In other words, as long as someone is cruel and hateful, they will be punished. Krishna doesn't say that I cast you there forever. He says, I will always cast cruel, hateful people into a lower position. Why? Because they are harming others. It's just like jurisprudence 101. I mean, if you go out and harm other people and then the law puts you behind bars, then that's fair. So Krishna does not say, I throw you into eternal darkness. He says that I will always punish the cruel and the hateful.
And then you have, it seems he has limits, like in the case of Shishupal. You know, so many insults, and then here comes the Sudarshan Chakra.
Well, actually, here comes liberation. it's like a parent. I mean, think of a loving parent. If the child misbehaves at a certain point, okay, that's it. Now you're in trouble. It's not that the parent has limited love for the child. It's just that the whole purpose of parenting is to do good to the child out of love. So when you see a certain number of misdeeds, it's clear that the person has a problem that needs to be corrected. For example, let's say someone coughs once or twice. It's like, okay, you cough once or twice. But if someone's coughing nonstop for an hour, they have a problem. So the duration of a particular activity gives us insight into the severity of the disease. And therefore, when Shishupala, at a certain point, Krishna said, okay, I'm going to put you in time out. And So he just, you know, he gave him that haircut, you know, at the neck. So it was actually an objective, compassionate thing to do. Yes. Microphone, please.
Thanks, Acharya Deva. Wonderful class. I wondered if you could sort of distinguish between the different concepts of causeless mercy, non-discrimination between different types of people, and what I'm, in my limited understanding, is a certain type of favoritism towards devotees.
Sure. Good topic. Causeless mercy as a phrase, as a term, is what I call emphatic redundancy. In other words, it's not misspeaking. But if you look at what the word mercy means causeless. In fact, mercy is always contrasted with justice. Justice is quid pro quo. You did this, you get that. Everything is symmetrical. The punishment fits the crime. The whole notion of mercy is that even though by justice, by sort of cold objective justice, you deserve this, but the judge is going to be merciful and give you a lighter sentence. So mercy, the English word mercy, or equivalent words in other languages, it means causeless. And so it's to say causeless mercy is to emphasize the nature of mercy. There's a common misunderstanding of this phrase, causeless mercy, as it's what I call hyperpiety, where a devotee may say something like, I absolutely did not deserve to be a devotee. I deserve to be taken to some planet where I was forced, the most horrible torture, forced to listen for thousands of years to public radio fundraising drives. It was probably like the worst punishment, I can think of. And so there is a type of speech in Krishna consciousness, which is what I call ecstatic speech. It's not literally true, but it expresses a devotee's ecstasy. For example, if Prabhupada says, I am very fallen, that's obviously not technically true. Prabhupada is not very fallen. And yet when he says that, it gives us a window into his ecstatic pure consciousness. So there are statements in Krishna consciousness which are not literally true, but rather express certain devotional sentiments. And so similarly, when a devotee says, I did nothing to deserve this, it has to be in that category. Because if for example, Krishna made you a devotee or brought you here really for no reason, then that would go against many teachings of the Bhagavad Gita. For example, Krishna says, Samoham Sarvam, I'm equal to all beings. So if you receive this mercy, although you absolutely didn't deserve it, that sounds really nice, but there's a sort of a very horrible corollary. Corollary means, something, another truth, which is entailed by the first one. And the corollary is that another soul who is equally a child of God, because Krishna says twice in the Gita and Arjuna says once, that Krishna is the father of this world and the mother, by the way. Pitahamasya jagato mata. And so there's another child equally deserving or equally undeserving that went to hell and you became a devotee. It's like imagine, say, two brothers in the same family and they do something wrong. They both do exactly the same thing. Maybe they're twins, so it's not the older one induced the younger one. They're both. And so the mother goes to the children, and one of them, they did exactly the same thing, and embraces a child and gives them, candy, and the other child, slaps him and, throws him out of the house. I mean, it's absurd. And so Krishna says, Samohang Sarvabhuteshu, I'm equal to all beings. He says, Jejata mam prapadyante, I exactly reciprocate with everyone. So how could those statements be true? If Krishna gives you something you didn't deserve, in fact, giving people things they don't deserve is not even good for them, as we know. And yet Krishna is very kind. But he gives us more than we deserve, you could say, because he's a loving parent, but he gives everyone more. And so, again, taking, I'm completely unqualified, I had no qualification, taking that to be literally true is a misunderstanding of our philosophy. Actually, you find this actually reached, how should I put it? It led to horrible consequences in the history of Christian theology. Because you have people like Calvin, who actually taught that, in sort of this misguided attempt to give all credit to God, that there's nothing you can do, I think Luther also, there's nothing you can do to earn God's mercy. Because if we say that you did anything at all to bring on God's mercy, you're taking credit away from God. You're trying to steal God's glory. Therefore, he gets 100% of the credit, you get zero credit. But the result is you have a monstrous God who does play favorites. So again, the term causeless mercy has to be understood from the Gita. Because as a hermeneutical principle, it means sort of a reasonable way to understand sacred text. If we have a term in English like causeless mercy, which is, it's a powerful term that we use, but we don't have literally, precisely that term in the original text. In Sanskrit, there is no statement in the Gita or the Bhagavatam, causeless mercy. And yet, I mean, it's not that we shouldn't use the term. It's not that it doesn't mean anything. But it's a sort of an emphatic way of speaking. So therefore, we have to understand the English term in a way that's consistent with the Shastra. And that's what Prabhupada taught us, Guru, Sadhu, and Shastra. So how can we understand the term causeless mercy in a way that is consistent with Bhagavad Gita and Srimad Bhagavatam? Krishna is infinitely merciful. Krishna is infinitely merciful, and mercy is that quality, which means it's not mere justice, it's actually mercy. And Krishna is infinitely merciful. And therefore, to say causeless mercy is to emphasize what the word means, to make it clear. So, thank you all very much, and Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.